This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. U.S. Founding Father Benjamin Franklin once said that those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Now, does this mean that Mr. Franklin intended that total freedom be protected at any cost, even if it meant endangering the citizens of the United States? The ongoing argument of freedom versus security has translated itself into modern times with the advent and growing importance of the Internet. Many of us have come to see the Internet as a double-edged sword. While it has proved to be an invaluable way of communication that allows us to gather and share a wide range of information, we're also exposed to possible dangers from those who would like to hurt us. Today on Encounter, we're going to examine Internet freedom and Internet security. Is it possible to have both an Internet that can effectively provide us with both liberty and safety? Joining me today on the phone from Nashville, Tennessee, is David L. Hudson, Jr. He's a law professor, First Amendment expert, and a First Amendment ombudsman at the Newseum Institute's First Amendment Center. And joining me from our New York studio is Elliot Zweig, Deputy Director of the Middle East Media Research Institute. Mr. Zweig is an expert on terrorist usage of the Internet. Welcome, gentlemen. David, is there such a thing as too much freedom on the Internet?
Well, possibly. The Internet is the most speech-enhancing, democratizing medium we've ever had. So it's amplified all forms of speech, the good, bad, and the ugly. So while there's a lot more positive speech on the Internet, I would have to concede that there's also a lot more negative, harmful material on the net as well.
Elliot, a lot of focus and concern lately has been about the use of the Internet and social media by terrorist militant groups such as ISIS. Now, how are groups like this able to take advantage of the Internet and social media?
Well, social media really represents a perfect tool for terrorist recruitment, propaganda, and outreach for a number of reasons. First of all, there's the mass audience, the widespread reach that's a given with the Internet and with social media. But particularly with social media, it's able to cast a net of potential younger recruits. That's the demographic on social media more so than the general Internet. And that demographic, of course, is those at an age that are more impressionable, perhaps, less stable in their life, and the age simply of fighting age males for the most part. And it's not limited to those who proactively seek out a certain message. In the past, perhaps you'd have to go to an Al-Qaeda website in order to be influenced by that material. You might now have a distant link, a cousin's friend, and it pops up on your feed, and you're now receiving that message. So the social media allows the terrorist organizations to go to where their potential audience is, a young audience, an audience that's able to customize, re-spread the message customized for their friends and social network in languages that they speak, and really crowdsource the distribution of that content on a massive scale.
So what do they get out of using social media?
They get several things. First, it depends on the audience. There's the recruitment aspect. We know certainly of an issue in the United States of young men and women going over to join ISIS, and that issue is much greater in Europe. There's the issue of simply intimidation, and you know, that's perhaps lesser of the two possible problems, but getting the message out that we are strong, we are spreading, and this is a movement that must be feared and must be joined.
David, with this in mind, with terrorist groups and the dangers that seem to lurk out in the Internet these days, should we be taking more aggressive security measures to protect ordinary Internet users from harm?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly you hope that the government's doing what it can to achieve its security objectives. But the phenomenon, of course, of using the Internet to recruit people is something that's been going on for quite some time. It's not confined to ISIS or all sorts of American-based hate groups that have used the Internet for recruitment. It's very difficult, I think, to further security objectives in a way that won't also stifle free speech. So we have to keep in mind always that balance between security and liberty.
And how would you suggest we do this?
Well, it's a good question. I think that we need to be very diligent in going on the Internet and possibly having some of these groups at least check out what's going on. I mean, the one thing about the First Amendment is we hope to counter negative speech with good speech, and perhaps if we can expose some of this speech and shine light on it, that perhaps we can take countermeasures.
Rick, if I may jump in, implicit in your question, I would say, is simply, where do we draw the line? Where do we draw the boundaries? And the good news that I have to share is that the social media companies have themselves drawn the line, even without government intervention. The problem comes when the social media companies draw that line and then fail to hold that line, fail to monitor that line. The terms of service of Twitter, 15 very simple words on this section. Users may not make threats of violence or promote violence, including threatening or promoting terrorism. So the line, I believe, as a society and to these individual companies, is fairly clearly drawn. It's similar terms for all the social media companies. The question is that those social media companies then fail to back up that line. Even if they shut a stray account, I'm talking particularly about Twitter now, those accounts come back. They even announce in advance, my account, if it gets shut down, here's going to be my next handle. Mm-hmm. Or if my handle is, you know, XYZ1, my next handle will be XYZ2. Come find me if you go to this account and it's shut down. So again, perhaps the good news is that for the most part, society and the social media companies have drawn a line. They just have not implemented it in any kind of comprehensive way.
Now, monitoring and removing terror-related content is one thing, but is there technology altogether for blocking unwanted postings? Does this exist?
That's a difficult question for an outsider to answer because we don't know what technologies are being worked on within the social media companies, within the technology firms. That being said, I think we can look to two things for some clarity. First, you will not find, or you will be very hard-pressed to find, pornography, especially child pornography, which is illegal, on YouTube, or links to it on these social media, on Twitter, on any of these. So we believe that there is likely technology and technological means to suss out these types of messages. We also can point to Facebook, which in our research is the company which does the best job of all, better than YouTube, better than Twitter. Accounts do occasionally get created and are active for a short amount of time and are inevitably shut down. We very rarely find those same people popping back up a day later, 2 days later, as we find on YouTube and on Twitter. So if Facebook can do it, and if Facebook seemingly has some technology to aid them in doing it, we believe that it should be feasibly capable for the other companies.
David, using and developing technology that would allow groups or companies or individuals to block unwanted postings is one thing. Is this type of work and research legal, at least here in the U.S.?
Yeah, no, I don't think it would be illegal for groups to develop technology that will allow blocking of unwanted posts. I think where it might run afoul of the First Amendment is if you have a governmental law, policy, or regulation that forces the removal of certain material. There's a fine line between, for instance, advocacy of illegal conduct, which may well be protected by the Supreme Court decision Brandenburg versus Ohio in 1969, and like Elliot said, things like child pornography, obscenity, a true threat, and what's referred to as incitement to imminent lawless action. I think the key legal question in this area, and it's admittedly a very difficult one to delineate the boundaries, is when does incendiary political rhetoric, when is that simply protected advocacy versus when is it unprotected incitement of imminent lawless action? And so a question that's confounded legal scholars for quite some time is, do we need to modify the very speech protective standards at issue in Brandenburg versus Ohio to deal with the new phenomenon of harmful speech on the internet?
So let me ask you this. What material should be scrutinized and perhaps set aside through various technologies and methods? And who would be the person, or who would be the one, group or whatever, determine the standard of what is harmful and offensive and should not appear on the internet, and material that should be allowed to have free access on the internet?
Well, that's a great question, because those determinations, if they're made by government officials, at least if we look historically at the regulation of other media, tended to lead to overregulation and censorship of unpopular political opinions. On the other hand, there's no doubt that there's some material on the internet that's quite harmful and dangerous. So it's just a very difficult line to draw.
Rick, if I may, I would say you can sort of start with the low-hanging fruit. You can start with official releases of designated foreign terrorist organizations. If Al-Qaeda puts out a branded official video, if ISIS puts out a branded official video, it's not necessarily dealing with speech of somebody saying, oh, Western imperialism drives me crazy and it makes me want to do something. But putting that aside, at the very least, you can start with those official designated terrorist organizations. And then you can move on to direct calls for violence, as David had mentioned, not necessarily, you know, somebody who is expressing an opinion or giving an unpopular complaint or gripe against the West, against America, but direct calls for violence. And you would be surprised. These videos that we're generally dealing with are not somebody getting up in a town square and saying, down with America, America is immoral. We're talking about beheadings videos. We're talking about direct calls to violence in the large majority of what memory is monitoring on the social media used by terrorists.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are David L. Hudson, Jr., a First Amendment expert, law professor, and a First Amendment ombudsman at the Newseum Institute's First Amendment Center, and Elliot Zweig, an expert on terrorist use of the internet and deputy director of the Middle East Media Research Institute. We're talking about internet freedom versus internet security. I am Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Encounter can also be heard online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And we'd also love to hear from you, so you can send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And speaking of Facebook, we'd like to give a shout out to our Facebook listener, Mohammed Arif from Afghanistan. Elliot, find to be looking at material coming from these terrorist organizations or subversive organizations. What about once the dialogue or the conversation moves from these organizations to just regular people discussing this, making plans on the internet? Should that be intercepted as well?
Well, certainly it depends what type of plans you're talking about.
They could grab some information from a website about how to do a particular attack on an area or whatever, and you have a group of people that decide that, you know, we're going to discuss this on the internet.
Discussion of immediate violence or calls for violence fall in a different category than legitimate debate, even if that legitimate debate is very heated, very anti-US, very anti-West. Discussions of we are going to have an attack, we are going to plan an attack, or one should go and attack this place because it's the home of this person or it's a legitimate target or something along those lines would fall, in our view, outside the bounds of the legitimate debate. And I will say we don't want to be the ones, and memory certainly has no role as the ones who are defining what is legitimate and what is not, but the government has been so far behind, whether in terms of the legislative process or of judicial review of legislative process, that the government, whatever action should be taken or at least debated, has really just started. And this is an issue that's been going back years, and their hand has been forced now by the social media companies for being inactive in policing their own policies against terrorist speech on the internet and on their sites.
Elliot, I think you're mentioning that the big need is for legislation and the legislative aspect of this. Again, I'm looking at technology. I'm just thinking how broad and how much material travels through the internet throughout the world every moment. Do you think it's possible that there could be technology or methods developed that would allow us to have this kind of tight scrutiny?
Again, I believe that it's possible. I cannot say with absolute certainty that that technology exists, but we have indications that it likely does based on its application to other objectionable content. I mentioned child pornography on YouTube, which you can't find, as well as the successful efforts that Facebook has undertaken as opposed to the other social media companies. I'd also say, though, that putting aside the issue of technology for a moment, if one simply wants to look at how terrorists use Twitter and the examples I gave of my account is going to be shut down find me at this account next. I mean, that seems to me fairly easy to police. I'll give you another example. Several years ago, YouTube said, we are not going to be the ones seeking out videos promoting terrorism on our site, but we'll put a feature for flagging. A user can go, if they come across this video, they can flag it and we'll review it. So what Memory did was we tested the flagging system. Again, this is not YouTube going out and finding these videos. It's Memory via the flagging system saying, hey, YouTube, here is objectionable content. We did a report in 2012 on videos of Anwar al-Awlaki, sort of the main jihadist figure on the internet. We flagged 127 videos. 1 week later, only 16 of 127 were taken down. We flagged in 2012 100 videos of Osama bin Laden and videos glorifying 9/11, not just glorifying, but calling for further violence. Out of those 100 that we flagged, 58 were left up. So I agree with you that there is a need for technology, but until we get to that point, if we're not already there, there's a lot that can be done that's not now being done.
David, let me ask you, it's one thing to monitor and block certain things from the internet. What about punishments for people who spread this unwanted material on the internet? Do you think that should be a standard as well?
Yeah, obviously, it'd have to be cabined to very narrow, explicit calls for immediate, imminent violence, I believe. You know, the difference we have in the United States from some of the European countries is that many of the European countries have what are known as glorification laws, so that it's unlawful to engage in speech that glorifies terrorism or glorifies mass violence. But would such a glorification law that does not call for imminent, immediate violence, I'm not sure that would meet the speech protective standard in Brandenburg versus Ohio. So any attempt to criminalize speech, I think, unless there's certainly a direct modification, it would have to fall into one of these narrow, unprotected categories of speech, such as Elliot mentioned, child pornography, incitement to imminent lawless action, true threats, etc.
Elliot, should there be a set of rules, I hate to use that word, but a set of rules for people to follow when they use the internet? Because if you start enacting legislation or pieces of legislation, it's going to be kind of tough to know how to behave on the internet.
I absolutely grant that. The one thing I would say in that regard is that while such legislation may be troubling, I would put my faith in the democratic process of debate, legislation, and judicial review to strike that correct balance. And if that correct balance is found, that policing people's actions on the internet in terms of what they're viewing is not the appropriate way, I would absolutely defer to that. And I believe that David has raised some very solid points in that regard. I will, however, say that the problem is not the recipients. The major issue is the distributors. And if you're able to shut down really either side, but it's easier to shut down the side of distribution to suppress that message and suppress, again, only the messages calling for direct violence, the messages of planning attacks, the messages of calling for recruitment to designated foreign terrorist organizations. If you're able to suppress that message, the audience side will not be nearly as problematic and nearly as important to address. And I do absolutely grant that there are far greater problems and free speech issues and issues that I would not want to enter into in terms of punitively dealing with people going to these sites and these messages as opposed to those who are spreading them.
David, I know that here in the United States, especially with some of the more popular websites and social media such as Facebook, Twitter, and so forth, that each of these organizations have something called terms of service. In other words, where they can outline, here's how you're going to use our service. Does that pass muster as far as being able to prevent, I guess, the freedom of speech?
Well, there's been a series of lawsuits where individuals, I remember early on, several people sued America Online because they got blocked or bumped or couldn't access certain material. The issue, however, is that, you know, we have the state action doctrine and constitutional law so that these private social media companies are not considered quasi-governmental actors. Now, the argument was made many years ago that some private property owners had such power and had such control over information that they were, in essence, a quasi-governmental actor, and we ought to extend the protections of the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment, to prohibit censorious actions by these private entities. That's something that has not occurred. So technically, these groups can set these terms of service as they wish, at least from a constitutional standpoint.
I know we've been talking about this on and off through our conversation here, but I'm going to ask both of you this question. Go to you first, Elliot. Legislation and various other similar proposals seem to be putting the onus of monitoring and protection on the providers and social media site operators. What is your opinion on this? Do these people foot everything?
First of all, as private companies, they certainly, not just maybe, but certainly are exempt. There's a different standard than government action is held to. Nonetheless, they answer to private sphere, and there should be pressure put on these companies by both the private sphere as well as possibly the government to monitor their site, for people to say, I don't want terrorist incitement on this site that I'm using, for which I'm a customer, which has a lot of my information is profiting from it. That being said, you know, government arguably has a role to play at the very least. I mean, Congress can call the heads of these companies, can subpoena them, can say, this terrorist attack, say in Garland, Texas, that took place a couple months ago, the gentleman who undertook it was in direct contact with terrorists on social media who encouraged him, pointed him to the target, so on and so forth. What do you say about that? What are you doing about it? And what do you have the ability to do about it? So at the very least, for there to be a process of questioning, of information gathering, and hoping then that the social media companies will be encouraged to actually police their site, to basically carry out their terms of service, which again are not legally binding, as David had pointed out, but which are at the very least the stated, at least implicitly stated, policy of these companies.
David, your opinion, should these providers and social media website operators take all the responsibility of making sure material that goes through their portals are considered safe or are not endangering anyone? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think they do have some level of social responsibility. The question becomes, you know, how do you enforce that? How do you ensure that? And if there is legislation, I think what it needs to be is a very deliberative, democratic process where we hear from all the people who have the technological know-how. We also hear from people familiar with the applicable constitutional standard, and we work out something carefully as opposed to perhaps acting too quickly and too hastily. You know, we look at maybe the lessons from United and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism, the USA Patriot Act, which I believe was passed 45 days after 9/11. I mean, we obviously don't want another 9/11, but we don't want to act too hastily and pass provisions that would unnecessarily encroach on freedom. What I would like to know more about is, how are we dealing with terror prosecutions? Are the current laws that we have too stifling of terror prosecutions, or on the other hand, are they too stifling of incendiary speech that does not lead to direct imminent call for violence? I mean, these are very difficult questions to consider before embarking on something that would really involve policing the internet.
And again, one of the things I've noticed in reviewing material for this is there seems to be a big issue of context on how this material is delivered. If it's delivered in a news fashion or historical fashion, should that material be allowed to be transmitted, Elliot?
Yeah, we have much less issue, and one could even say no issue, with material being transmitted in historic fashion, news fashion, saying even if it's false that the U.S. is bad for this reason or U.S. policy is enraging for that reason. What we're dealing with, for the most part, is calls for active violence against civilians and against what the West, both government and civilian. And we're dealing, to a very large extent, with official communications put out by terrorist organizations.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, David L. Hudson Jr., a First Amendment expert, law professor, and a First Amendment ombudsman at the Newseum Institute's First Amendment Center, and Elliot Zweig, an expert on terrorist use of the internet and deputy director of the Middle East Media Research Institute, who joined us today from VOA's New York studio. Encounter was produced in Washington. We want to thank Anna Zaleski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.